Denise Mata, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you for having me.
Coming all the way from Glasgow, Scotland. Now, did I pronounce that correctly? Glasgow?
Chef's kiss. Beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Americans usually say Glasgow, but you said Glasgow.
I did. I got lucky.
You did.
So, Denise, thank you for coming back on the show. As you already know, I'm a fan of your work. I always enjoy interviewing you. I do want to, though, lay some roses at Rizzo, the book Rizzo, again, because I will tell you that when that book came out, I said, I just want to interview Denise Mata. I didn't think, I was like, I don't know about this book, but I know about Denise Mata. I love interviewing her. And I tell you, I'm just going to say the way that historical mystery, you did such a superb job as I read through that book. So I was thinking about that today. So let me tell you again, if you haven't read Rizzo, you need to go back and read Rizzo. But let's talk about your latest book, Confidence. And this is the second book in the Anna and Finn series that you started, first book published in 2019. So what is Confidence about?
Well, Confidence is about it's about someone who finds an Urbex video on YouTube. And it's a woman who breaks into, I don't know if you know what Urbex is, it's urban exploring. People break into abandoned buildings and have a look around and they take kind of nice pictures. So she breaks in and it's a really strange chateau in France. And she finds a secret room that nobody really knows is there. And inside the room, she finds a casket. And on the top of the casket, it says, "This belonged to Pontius Pilate and it contains proof of the resurrection of Christ." And then she goes missing, like Gabby Petito, and the casket turns up for auction in Paris. And everyone cares about the casket, obviously, but nobody really cares about the girl who found it, who's gone missing. So Anna and Finn are on holiday with their blended families. They discover very quickly that that's a nightmarishly foolhardy thing to have done. And they run away and go and try and save the girl rather than deal with their difficult families. So that's basically what happens in the story. And it's really about proof and faith. I think faith is the big issue of our age. Absolute beliefs. If you've disagreed with anybody about politics over the past 10 years and you've been left baffled by why no one can hear anybody else, then this book is basically an exploration of that issue of what is faith and why do people treasure their faith so much? And why do we treasure totems of faith? And what is the point of adding monetary value to these things? And just to how complex that is. But mostly it's just people chasing around in helicopters.
What inspired you to write the book? And I will tell you, if you start talking about ancient artifacts, you got me hooked.
Yeah.
And then you throw in, I mean, it's like, okay, ancient artifact. Wow. I'm a sucker for the ancient artifact mystery thriller. So when you started writing this second book in the Anna Finn series, at the very beginning, were you thinking an ancient artifact plot?
Yes. What is it? There's something about chasing one object. I mean, the thing in crime fiction is you're always trying to think of a way of pinpointing the object of all the characters. Now, with an actual object, I spend a lot of time in museums, and I love British museums because we are going to have to give all that stuff back one day, and it's not going to be here forever. I mean, we have Benin bronze heads. I don't know if you know about the Benin bronze heads, but these are priceless ancient artifacts that we are starting to give back to the people that we just stole them from. You know, we have like Easter Island heads in the middle of the British Museum. And I read a brilliant book about the British Museum and they were saying, they keep asking the board if they should give all these priceless treasures stolen during colonialism back to the people they took them from. But the board is made up of the people who made their fortunes during colonialism. So obviously they keep saying no. Do you know what I mean? So repatriation of these objects, ownership of these objects is so interesting. And so, I mean, it's just like, it is that thing. But also what I really wanted to talk about was proof in faith. And, you know, I don't know if you saw any footage of people being shown video from the January the 6th hearings of Ivanka and saying, "I knew the election had not been stolen." And they think it's deep fake. Because when you see something that contradicts your core faith beliefs, you just disbelieve it. So what is going on there with proof and faith? I think that's fascinating. And the idea that heritage and faith could be up for sale, you know, I've always been really interested. One of the characters is called Voynich. And I don't know if you know about the Voynich manuscripts, do you?
Yes, yes. I looked it up, actually. I looked at Voynich casket and Voynich manuscript from the 1500s. They still haven't figured it out.
It's a fake. It's a fake. It's just.
It's a fake?
I know it's a fake. I've got it. I've tried to crack it. So for people who are not nerdy, right? The Voynich manuscript is a medieval manuscript that is supposed to have all sorts of secrets in it, but it's written in a code. And people have been trying to crack this code for like 600 years. Nobody can crack it, but it was sold as a priceless artifact. And just if you could just crack that code, you would have all sorts of secrets about medicine and truth and, you know, staying young and, you know, turning stone into gold and all this kind of thing. But you had to crack the code. I mean, it was a brilliant con. It was an absolutely amazing con. And you can buy, like, off Amazon, you can buy a cheap reproduction of it, and it's mesmerizing. But, you know, I mean, all these kind of relics that were kind of kicking about at the time, apparently they had enough splinters of the True Cross to build a bridge from Gibraltar to North Africa because, you know...
Well, there's this author I've been reading. He's written 10 or 12 books. It's set during the time of King Alfred. And you probably know who he is. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I've read 8 or 9 books in it. And one of the things you pick up from the book is this emphasis at that point in time, set around, I guess, 800, 900 AD. The emphasis on these relics, how important these relics are to the people at the time. And the main character in this novel, born English or Saxon, but gets taken by a Viking family. So it's interesting how much emphasis, and to this day, as in your novel, people put on relics or proof of things from the past. But I have to ask you, when I looked at Voynich's casket, your Voynich is V-O-Y-N-I-C-H-E, but what popped up was V-O-Y-N-I-C-H. So when you came up with the name of the Voynich casket and the character of the Voynich, was that based on the Voynich manuscript? You just wanted to play with that little puzzle from the past?
Yes, that's exactly it. But I wanted to add an E in case someone has the copyright of the Voynich manuscript. I mean, it's inconceivable, but it is possible. And I just thought somebody clearly owns that and I don't want to get into trouble. So it was a reference to that, but it wasn't the person who owns the relic. So it was, you know, there was kind of a play on that. But I just think the Voynich manuscript is such a great story. And, you know, there's a lot of Easter eggs in the book about things that I came across. There's a fantastic long form, I think it was in the Atlantic, essay about the finding of a silver hoard in Hungary during the communist era. And it did happen that someone dug it up, hid it in a shed, and then a whole series of people died. And then all of a sudden this silver hoard, priceless silver hoard, was up for sale in Christie's and had to be withdrawn. So there's lots of Easter, if you're really interested in that kind of thing, there's lots of Easter eggs in the book about research that I got very excited about, couldn't convince anyone else to care about or shoehorn into the story and managed to get in somehow or other.
Well, I know there were going to be Easter eggs when I looked up Gary Warren, founder of the San Francisco Suicide Club, because when you told that story in the book, I said, let me look this up. I said, oh, my God, it's real.
Yeah. Lots of the stuff is real. Burning Man came from this suicide club. And the suicide club was called after Robert Louis Stevenson. So, you know, there's lots of layers in the book. And I wanted to have that mix of truth and fiction. And, you know, are you going to go along with me on this faith journey? Are you going to believe the stuff that's not true? But the Gary Warren story, I just think is such a totemic story of our times because they were anti-capitalist. And then all of a sudden you have to pay $500 to get into Burning Man. And it's just influencers and, you know, tech bros. And it's all just become commodified. Everything's commodified. And it was such a great movement. That movement was so great.
So the Anna and Finn are part of a podcast, I believe, with Trina. And talk a little bit about the creation of the very first book. So people have a little bit of background. The book was a Reese Witherspoon book club selection. I looked it up on Goodreads. You had 41,000 reviews. All your other books, 3,000 reviews, 5,000, 4,000, 6,000. Then you get to Conviction, and it's 41,000 reviews. Wow. I was like, wow.
That's amazing. You know, a lot of writers have a vow never to go on Goodreads because it's just really heartbreaking. People are just hungry and they hate your book. And you're really upset about it. And then you're like, I don't know you. And maybe you were just having, I've read books and hated them. You know, so I wouldn't know that. But that, I mean, that is the power of the Reese Witherspoon Book Club. It is so powerful. It brings books to so many people. And essentially what that book club says is, don't be intimidated by this story. You might like this, you know. It's such a powerful thing. They did me so many favors. I can't thank them enough. It was a New York Times bestseller because of that book club. They're amazing.
But so how did you come up to start a series featuring two podcasters? Because that's sort of a, like my daughter recently was criticizing a young adult writer. My daughter does a podcast with book interviews. And she was saying, oh, this writer, she doesn't get, because the protagonist was 16, my daughter's 16, the writer was maybe, I don't know, 40. She's like, she doesn't get the young adult. She doesn't really get it. She missed this, she missed that. Do you ever think that when you're writing these stories that, frankly, the social media trends sort of came, I think you and I were researching books in the library, Reader's Periodical Guide. I mean, we were pulling books out. We didn't have the internet. That was so much how we had to do things. Now you can just do so much research. So talk a little bit about your decision to have protagonists that were podcasters in the very first book, Conviction.
You know, particularly in crime writing, we don't like tech. We're scared of tech. And I think older people who write are very frightened of talking about tech. So there was a period of about 2 years when everyone was setting things slightly ago because they just didn't want to have to deal with the fact that you don't have to run away from the murderer. You just get in a cupboard and phone the cops, or you get in a cupboard and phone your accomplice, or, you know, you phone an Uber or some stuff. Do you know what I mean? And also, you know, people worry about their books lasting forever and being relevant and understandable forever, and things are changing so quickly. So I just thought, well, why not just lean into that? And podcasts were quite a marginal interest at the time. They're huge now. But when I wrote that first book, I just thought it was such an interesting form to tell a story and to be told a story in your ear pod. You know what I mean? Like somebody whispering a story in your ear, and how beguiling and comforting that was. And at that time, podcasts were, some of them were, you know, here we are on Wondery, this is all sponsored, we have an office. But some of them were just people recording things, sometimes quite badly, and throwing them out in chunks. And I love the idea of armchair detectives, because they were crazy reckless at the beginning. They were saying things like, it wasn't this guy who did the murder, it was Mrs. So-and-so at number 17. And people were turning up at their door because people didn't think anyone was going to listen. So I was just really interested in the idea that people would form vigilante groups or be armchair detectives. Or during Serial, a lot of people went there and they looked for clues and they looked for, you know, information, and they were hunting down people like Jay. And I just thought that's such an interesting premise for a book. But I didn't think podcasts, I mean, somebody interviewed me about that book and said, you know, aren't you worried that podcasts are going to be a passing fad? But I think we should really, particularly in crime fiction, we should really embrace the ephemeral, because it is what we have over literature. We're not writing for the ages. And I know beautiful, beautiful literary writers who are writing for the ages. And for whatever reason, they get forgotten. So why not just write the story that you want to read at that time? And at that particular time, and I wrote this book during COVID, but the first book, really all I wanted to do was run. I had a really strong urge to run away. And I thought, that's so identifiable, the urge to run out of your life and into another story. I thought that was, you know, something that I hadn't read, was the urge just to get up and run and go and solve a crime.
Well, this is where fiction is imitating life, because to some degree, true crime podcasters are sort of like the new armchair detectives, amateur detectives of today.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't always know what they're doing. And, you know, if you are also the idea that you can't hide anymore because of face recognition and stuff like that. You know, if you are in hiding, how do you hide? How does anybody hide anymore? Because everyone's got cameras. Everyone's being traced all the time. You know, how do you, because Anna has a secret and she doesn't want to be photographed. And, you know, the idea of being on the run or being discovered or, you know, I mean, I just really wanted to lean into tech and embrace it and say this in this moment, this is what we have. And this is a story that could have happened. And I think sometimes when you stumble across things in books that are very familiar to you, and be it a city, be it podcasts, be it a particular type of car, it helps to suspend disbelief in the story because you think, yeah, I smoke Marlboro, or yeah, I drink that drink, you know, or yeah, I have a Mac. Do you know what I mean? Or I drink coffee. Yeah.
So well, they do a lot of cigarette smoking, though.
Yeah.
There's a lot of cigarette smoking. They're handing out. I do want to talk about Bram Van Wyck, who's an incredible character, by the way. Incredible character. Former drug dealer from South Africa, art smuggler. And one of the things, I don't know if you want me to include this in it, but one of the brilliant things about the plot is he's stuck with his son. I believe his 15-year-old son. Who he didn't even know he had a son. And so the mother sends the son to stay with him. And this character actually has a pass with the Voynich casket and pushes himself on Anna and Finn. And they end up becoming this unexpected trio. And Trina at some point joins in, trying to find out, number one, what happened to Lisa Lee. Number two, what the heck happened with this casket? So talk about the creation of Bram. I absolutely love this character.
Bram is a narcissist. So Bram, I just love this guy.
So you're telling me I love a narcissist?
No, I just think confident people are really mesmerizing. So I was kind of thinking about Trump and I was thinking, he's so hateful. Why do people like him? If he had the same politics as me, would I still hate him? Yeah, I would. But at the same time, I have met people like that and I've been taken in by people like that. You see a lot of people in the arts like that. And, you know, you meet visual artists and they're not that great and they have workshops of people making things, but they're just very confident. And they just look you in the eye and lie to you. And, you know, like Trump with his money, that guy's broke. That guy is broke. And he looks you in the eye and he says, I've got a lot of money, and he gets a loan. There's something kind of messy. I just thought, wouldn't it be great to take those bits of those people? Because we have our own Trump here, you know, Boris Johnson. Yes. And he is just full of BS in exactly the same way. But people want to be taken in by him. And it is a living. It's a living. But anyway, I just thought, you know, I just want to make a really bigger than life character who has to do quite mundane things like connect with his son. And you know, if you have teenagers, I know you've had teenagers, it's very hard to be pompous if you have teenagers and are spending time with them.
Marcus, yeah, you have his son is, let's just say he has a potty mouth and he's not impressed by his dad.
But you know, a lot of drug dealers, international drug dealers, did go on to art smuggling because you got 2 years for art smuggling and you got life for heroin. So they started to discover, you know, like Roman sculptures wrapped up in the same packaging as heroin, using the same roots as heroin. And it all comes through London. Nobody wants to talk about it. It all comes through London. There's a Norwegian millionaire who lives on a ship called The World, which Terra Nova is based on. And this ship moves around and it's full of millionaires. It moves around the world so they never have to pay tax anywhere. Now, that guy has the very first manuscripts of written language anywhere in the world, and he keeps them on that ship. What if that ship sinks? Do you know, what are we doing? This is such a bad way to organize everything.
Well, and then the character Voynich is the one that lives on the Terra Nova, right?
Yes.
Right. He's on the Terra Nova. Yeah. So when I read these novels, number one, I had never heard of urban exploration or I forgot learning about it. And then I had never heard of the Terra Nova. And then the Voynich casket led me to the Voynich manuscript. And so all these Easter eggs. And then, of course, I mentioned the Gary Warren, founder of the San Francisco Suicide Club. So one of the things that's really entertaining about reading your books is I bet you figure out a lot of your readers start looking stuff up. And it's always such a gift when you look stuff up and you can go, wow. Is that something like as you've transitioned from writing before we could look it up to writing when you can actually look it up in minutes? Has that ever affected how you write your stories, knowing that readers could literally just say, I'm going to go on Google and Google this, or I'm going to go to Wikipedia and look this up?
Yes. One of the things I wanted to reproduce with this book is the experience of watching a story or reading a story and looking things up. Because that's how we all read these fractured stories now, watching a movie, looking things up. Is that true? Was there someone called, what happened to that actor? I vaguely know him. What else was he in? That multifaceted, multi-layered way of receiving stories, because it should be terrible, but actually it's very, I love it. I find it incredibly engaging. And, you know, we talk about people having a very short attention span. I, as a viewer, as a reader, as a watcher, find myself more intensely engaged. I was watching The Offer. Have you seen that? It was about the making of The Godfather.
Oh, I haven't. I'm down to the last episode. I absolutely love it. I love it.
Are you looking everything up?
Yes, of course. Did the mafia really threaten the producer of The Godfather? Yeah. Were they really in line together working? Yes.
What an interesting way to receive a story. It's like reading comics. You can feel all the bits of your brain working. And it feels like a 3D experience as opposed to a one-dimensional reception of a story. So that's what I'm trying to reproduce in these books, is that slightly fractured, multi-source narrative for the reader.
Paul Hammersmith, I looked him up, but he was not an American evangelical billionaire. But is that character based on an American evangelical billionaire?
Yes.
Who is it?
It is.
Can you tell me?
I can't. Well, see, I changed his name to something untraceable.
Okay.
But it's Hobby Lobby.
Okay.
Okay, so it's Hobby Lobby. It's the Hobby Lobby family who made a huge amount of money, opened a Museum of the Bible in Washington, and have set fire to the international Christian relics market, which is just, and they bought a whole lot of stuff that was completely irrelevant to Christianity, and a lot of it was forgeries. So they created, they employed a whole lot of academics. Yeah, they had to get outsiders to come in and look at it. That whole scandal has been completely swept under the carpet. They had to get, they had something like 400 documents, cuneiform documents. I'm not going to explain cuneiform because I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So they had all these cuneiform documents, and something like 390 were fake. And they bought them all, and they had set fire to the market. So obviously, because if you set fire to a market like that because you're paying over the odds, I totally understand where they're coming from. That's their faith. They want to spend the money that they've made on that. They don't want to spend it on taxes or roads or schools. They want to spend it on stuff that relates to their faith. And they set fire to that. So now what you have in Iraq is you have villages digging up old temples and you know, mistreating really important finds because they don't have any money because the country is at war, and you know, selling them to, you know, smugglers who are bringing them and selling them to the Museum of the Bible. And it's, you know, it's an international outrage, and it's really never addressed. But that Paul Hammersmith was based on that. And if you're interested in that particular scandal, I've changed a lot of the facts because I don't want to reproduce it because I understand they might be a bit litigious. I don't want to insult anybody inadvertently because, you know, I mean, there's so much stuff in this book that I don't want to get sued.
I was thinking about that. I will ask you, though, as you write these books, how do you balance how much exposition you need to have so people understand something versus, okay, this should be in the general popular imagination. Like, we're watching Ms. Marvel, my daughter and I, and I had to ask, I said, do you know what the partition is? And I was so proud. My 16-year-old goes, yes, Dad, it was when they divided India, you know, Bangladesh and Pakistan. And then I said, okay, I don't have to explain that to you.
Yeah. But a lot of people won't know that. And a lot of people will pause it and look it up. That's the wonder of that show. That is a brilliant show because so many people in Britain don't know about that. That was our fault. And people in Britain don't know about that. There's a fantastic writer called Abir Mukherjee, who's a Scottish guy, and he writes books set in pre-independence India. And he writes about things like Winston Churchill single-handedly causing the famine in Calcutta during the war by exporting all the grain. I mean, these are things people don't know anything about. They don't understand why India wanted independence. And then if it takes you, if a work of popular fiction takes you away and makes you think about these things, you know, I mean, it can change people's views of history.
I want to talk about family drama because there is a secondary plot. There is a lot of family drama in here. And of course, they didn't read The Conviction. So if they're reading for about the background of Anna for the very first time, she has a bit of a dark past. But I will tell you this, when I read how she orchestrated this blended family vacation, I said, oh my God, this is a powder keg. This is a accident waiting to happen. Though she has a great relationship with her ex-husband's wife. And actually, there's just one person, if she had listened to Finn and did not invite, maybe there wouldn't be all this drama going on. So you really turned up the fire on the family drama by adding Sophia to this vacation. Sophia.
Well, you know, I think in the States, you're about one generation further on in blended families than we are here. So here people are very naive about blended families. But I think in the States, people are a little bit more savvy about what can go wrong. We had Texan friends when we lived in Paris when I was a kid, because my dad worked in the oil industry. And I remember one of them was telling a story about her daughter's ex-husband had come over to visit. And they had an arm wrestling competition between the ex-husband and the new husband. We thought this was the most glamorous thing we'd ever heard. And the ex-husband was winning. And then he accidentally did a little gusty noise.
Wow.
And he was very humiliated. But we thought that was a story like you know, Jackie Onassis could have been in the background. Because it was like no one got divorced that we knew, you know.
So why did you do this to Finn? Why did you give him a girlfriend like Sophia? You must not like that character a whole lot.
Well, Sophia, you know, I mean, she was kind of based on girlfriends of glamorous friends who are on the rebound. And very often they pick someone who looks the opposite of their partner and who's very attractive. And then they spend time with them and realize they're a nightmare. But they've inflicted them on all their friends by then. And they have to get rid of them. But, you know, not to spoil anything, there is a happy ending for Finn because Finn's such a good guy. But I think if you're friends with a lot of men, you become aware that a lot of men go out with women because they find them attractive and not because they find them interesting to chat to. If that's... And we have to listen to that stuff.
Oh, Lord. That was... Let's just say she texts a whole lot. Poor Finn, he should have just turned his phone off, you know, once he made that decision. Just turn your phone off.
She's very good looking. She's very good looking.
What will you put up? So is this a critique of men who put up with a lot because the woman's super good looking? But not interesting.
You know, as the friend of a lot of men, it is kind of like, you know, think about what the rest of us are getting out of this. She's a nightmare.
Eugene Lamberg, but so, I do want to go back to Bram because you did, like, I don't want the audience to think Bram and Trump, because he did have some redeeming qualities.
He's not Trump. Please don't think he's Trump, but he is actually, he's one of those international men of mystery who's actually quite a pudgy old guy who's losing his hair. So he's kind of what James Bond is like versus, but he thinks he is James Bond. So, and he's a very loving character. He's very warm. And at the end, he makes a decision that is really sort of history changing. And he does it because he admires the qualities that he doesn't have in other people, which I think is quite a beautiful thing.
And also, he recognizes the privilege he had growing up in South Africa.
Yes, he does. And he grew up, I think people who come from South Africa, I was reading this fantastic book called In the Garden of the Innocents. I think it was Kerdin Dwovi. She's quite South African. And it was people from South Africa. It was about people from South Africa who go into therapy for they have crippling guilt because of their privileged upbringing and because of the violence inflicted in their name by the state. And apparently all the therapists who do this particular practice come from Germany. This practice was developed in Germany because of the violence inflicted on the Jews there. I just thought that was so interesting to own that, you know? I thought that was great.
And the last character we have to talk about is Eugene Lamberg. I guess that's just one of his names. Is he a priest? Is he not a priest? Communist Hungary, Boston, Rome, I guess. He's an interesting sort of conflicted character.
He's a priest who was ordained under communism in the forest seminaries. So one of the things I really admire about American Catholicism is it's not enthralled to the Vatican the way we are in Europe. I'm not Catholic, by the way, but this is just like my family and it's, you know, sort of where I live. I always really admire people who do not do what they're told. And Lamberg is absolutely certain he's right and he doesn't have anyone to take. He is a priest, a sort of rogue priest, who's kind of going about ministering to people when he shouldn't be. And he's trying to help the faith in sometimes very misguided ways.
So the book opens with the Bloody Casket podcast. And so as you did your research, have you run across artifacts that are cursed?
Cursed artifacts. Man, I don't know. Do you know, I've written a series for the radio about Savonarola. I don't know if you know about Savonarola.
I don't.
He was 1840. He was really the start of the Reformation. And Savonarola started a sort of socialist, anti-Semitic, homophobic republic in Florence in 1490, and they had the bonfire of the vanities. They had a trial by fire where you had one set of monks had to stand at one end, the other set of monks had to stand at the other end. They walked through a tunnel of fire, and God decides who's lying and who isn't lying, and he was eventually executed, and they broke up his bones because they didn't want to preserve relics. They didn't want relics to be preserved. But what they didn't realize was the printing press had just been invented or was just about to be invented. And the real relics now, of course, are writing. That's what a real relic is. So I think there are cursed texts. And, the Russian Revolution was really started by quite a cheap book. I think it was called How We Live Now, which affected Lenin more than Marx's work. The Mein Kampf, which is one of the worst written books you've ever read in your life, that started a revolution. So I think there are texts that are really cursed. The white supremacist movement in the States was really about the, what was it called? The Something Diaries. And that was what inspired the Oklahoma bomber. So I think there are cursed texts more than objects.
Well, this is a book it's a thriller. There's family drama. There's great history, faith. But I'm going to close with a quote from Bob Lee. And this is the way I want to end this interview. It's a bloody scavenger hunt. Denise Mina, author of Confidence, her second book in the Anna and Finn series. When is the next one coming out?
Probably in a couple of years.
All right.
I'm writing a Philip Marlowe book for the Chandler Estate at the moment. Yeah.
When is that one coming out?
That's coming out, I think, next year, end of next year.
Denise, thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
That's my absolute pleasure, Hope, and I hope you're well.
Thank you for listening to this podcast edition of Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.